Open up the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Today, it looks like we're a committee of one for a few more minutes. Representative Richardson is excused for other business, and we may be doing other excuses as the meeting moves on. Today, we're going to open public hearings on Senate Bill 5515, Housing and Community Services Department, and also House Bill 2052 related to housing. What I'm intending to do is start off with public hearings on House Bill 2052, and if Jack Kenny wants to come up, and if the Treasurer's Office, Laura Lockwood McCall, wants to come up.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Smith.
Member.
My name is Jack Kenny. I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to speak in support of House Bill 2052. This bill increases the debt limit in ORS 456-661 on Oregon Housing and Community Services outstanding revenue bond. It increases it to $2.5 billion. The increase is necessary to enable the department to maintain its programs at current levels that serve first-time home buyers and provide below-market rents to renters. Our single-family loan program provides below-market financing to low and first-time, low and moderate first-time home buyers. Through these mortgages, we provide increased purchasing power and closing cost assistance to qualifying Oregonians. Program loans originated through banks and other mortgage lenders. We currently have loans in 35 counties. And last year, 81% of our loans were to households at or below 80% of area median income. In calendar year 2004, we made loans of $169.5 million to 1,357 households. It is an effective tool to assist Oregonians looking to buy their first time, their first home. Borrowers must secure FHA or rural development or conventional insurance unless they provide 20% down payment assistance. And I'll discuss that a little bit more in a minute. The minimum this minimizes the risk to bondholders. And our default rate in the fourth quarter, as was discussed in yesterday's testimony, is more than a full percentage point below national average. We also use short-term escrow bonds to ensure efficient resources are available to maintain our programs. Investments that back up those short-term bonds are in U.S. Treasury or government securities, and that provides protection for the short-term bondholders. Our multi-unit programs generally serve Oregonians at or below 60% of area median income. In calendar year 2004, we issued over $81 million in loans through our multi-unit programs and provided 1,294 units of affordable housing. These loans are made primarily through the HUD risk-sharing program, and risk is shared in equal parts with the federal government and the state, or through our conduit program where there is no risk to the state in the event of a default. Both housing prices and the need and the increasing need for affordable housing in Oregon have grown significantly in recent years, and to maintain our current level of activity in the future, OHCS requires an increase to the outstanding revenue bond debt limit. We project that the existing debt limit will be reached and exceeded in the 2005-07 biennium. Existing safeguards will remain in place, including approval of all new debt issuance by the Office of the State Treasurer. I appreciate the opportunity to meet with you this afternoon. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of the committee? Geez. really quick, a couple questions. What's the current statutory debt limit that you operate under?
For the revenue bond programs, and I should distinguish that from the general obligation bonds, the general obligation bond debt limit is set in the Constitution. This does not deal with general obligation bonds, so these bonds are only backed by program revenues, and the taxpayers would not be on the hook in the event of the default. But the current statutory debt limit for the revenue bond program is $2
billion. Okay, so we're going up
half a billion.
Half a billion, okay. What percentage of that portfolio is currently loaned out?
We have about $600 million in our single-family program, approximately. I think it was about $585 million the last time we had audited financial statements. The multi-unit program has about $200 million. I'm looking at Rick, but it's in the $200 million range. So there's probably $800 to $850 million in outstanding loans, and the balance would be in escrow bonds, which are those short-term bonds that I referred to in my testimony.
So just unclear, $850 is loaned out?
Yes.
And you're looking to go to 2.5?
Yes, it's...
What am I missing here?
Sure.
Yeah, please just introduce yourself.
For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall, Director of Debt Management, Oregon State Treasury. When, as a backdrop to the overall housing finance program, under federal tax law, the types of financings that we're doing for housing require what's known as a private activity bond cap allocation. One of the reasons that the program has grown is obviously the program needs population, cost of housing, but also there's been a sharp increase in the last few years in the number of escrow bonds. Every year the state legislature allocates this capacity to a number of different issuers, and then the balance goes to the Private Activity Bond Committee, which is composed of the state treasurer, director of administrative services, and a public member. What's happened is that there hasn't been an interest, particularly from industrial development bond financiers and other local housing agencies, in using the cap. And the balance each year for the last few years has gone to the Department of Housing and Community Services. What we've been doing is escrowing these proceeds to make sure that we don't lose this capacity for private activity in future mortgage revenue bonds, but rather we've been keeping in relatively short-term products. And what has happened is in our attempt to save our capacity for future use, we have about a three-year period after the year that is allocated by the federal government to use it, we've pushed up against their debt limits. So the program is growing at a more slow and stately pace, as the cash flows that are reviewed each time we do a transaction would indicate that everything is still in good order. But the escrowed portion, in essence, the part that we're trying to protect and save for Oregon, has been starting to escalate. What happened very briefly at the end of the last calendar year is that for a brief moment we were at that cap. Then prepays came in, and we knocked down that number to the outstanding balance, which I believe is outstanding is now approximately $1.6 billion. For an example, we had a private activity bond committee meeting scheduled next week. No requests. We have roughly $90 million of allocation available to issuers throughout the state of Oregon. And if last year and the year before is any sort of precedent, my guess will be is toward the end of the year we'll look around and housing will ask us to take the balance of the cap for the 2005 period and bring it in and try and then slowly use the money for various programs, both for single-family and multifamily housing programs.
Just so I'm clear on a definition, escrow, in my mind, means the equivalent of a savings account.
Okay, and that may not be really the way that we use the term for you. We keep them in relatively short-term securities.
Okay.
And what we're able to do is that the earnings on the funds are roughly approximate to the debt service costs. So we're just holding the funds in a short-term mode, and then we're rolling it out into long-term fixed-rate debt or variable-rate debt, as it might be, but with a long-term amortization for real-life mortgages. But the system couldn't support. There wouldn't be enough interest to roll out all several hundred million at the same time. So it's a bit of a balancing act to try and bring this into the market. We just are closing a transaction this week or next week to do some single-family housing mortgages, but we need to sort of spurt it out, for lack of a more professional term, in small chunks to manage what the marketplace will do rather than just to lose it entirely as a resource for the state.
If I could add to that, we're kind of in a unique situation. As I mentioned in my testimony, we did $169 million in single-family loans last year, and we did $81 million in multifamily loans. So that's $250 million in activity in one calendar year. Yet the allocation that we get from the Private Activity Bond Committee is less. It's probably $140 million. From the legislature.
Yeah.
Is somewhere between $140 and $170 million. So we really, our program, due both to the demand for affordable housing in Oregon and due to housing costs in Oregon, are well beyond the ability of the state's allocation of this federal resource to operate.
Let's do this. And if I'm dummying this down for you, Senator, I apologize, but I want to make sure I understand this. 2.5, is the cap we're looking to go towards.
Correct.
Okay. Let's go down from there. Tell me, how do we get to 2.5?
Well, as Laura mentioned, we hit up against the 2 billion cap this biennium, and so we're...
Okay, let me stop there. You know, okay. Senator, I hope you'll indulge me in understanding
absolutely.
This.
Absolutely, okay. Absolutely.
We hit up on the $2 billion cap...
Temporarily.
Through our lending activities...
Correct.
...and having outstanding credits near $2 billion.
That's right. There's some timing issues sometimes that... Correct. So, I mean, if you looked at a chart at any given point in time at the end of a month, you would see ups and downs. So, currently, we're at $1.5 billion, but we're about, and maybe up a little, but we're about to add to that.
You're $1.5 billion in total outstanding debt.
Right.
Okay, where did I get confused on the 850?
That was outstanding loans. So, when you would ask the question, I thought you were referring to loans for mortgages, for apartment buildings, and first-time home
and
buyers.
The difference between the 850 and the 1.5 is in escrow.
Escrow.
Well, it's in short-term securities that are we're
and
holding on to our
private. And those dollars we can use to revolve to put into other projects.
Yes, sir.
Right.
But we need to actually roll that out over a 3 to 4 year period, or we'll have to retire the bonds, and we will lose. The private activity bond
because
allocated.
The covenant of the bond is it has to be used through and continue to be
well through tax law gives it a 3 year period, but then there's new money that gets added to those. So the following year, they'll, as Laura mentioned, at the end of the year, there'll probably be new additional sources, and that's kind of how we run our program. We have been running our program for the last several years.
Okay, now I'm up to speed on that.
Okay,
tell me why would we not use the escrow dollars rather than borrow another half billion.
We will use some escrow dollars, but as Laura said, it's coming out kind of in spurts. So we'll draw down part of the escrow dollars.
Okay.
But then there'll be new resources available to the state. And if we don't keep adding the new escrow dollars eventually, and we used to do this, it used to be in when there was more activity in the economic development arena for these bonds, we actually had a projected date when we would essentially have to stop or cut severely back on our program.
So you're using two streams of income then.
Correct.
Two streams
of resources.
Of resources.
Right.
To make a project happen.
That's right. And because, and it's, I mean, it really can get extremely complicated, but due to the tax law, there's kind of,
sure.
You use kind of what's available before it expires, and then as new money comes available, you kind of put that at the back of the queue.
And these are collateralized once again by?
Short-term government securities, usually treasury bonds or government agencies.
And not the?
Not the full faith and credit of the state. And the mortgages that underlie the bonds are usually backed by FHA insurance, private mortgage
Got
insurance.
It.
So it's an extremely conservative, safe
Got
investment.
It. Got it. Thank
and
you very much.
Okay.
I think I got her.
All right.
Good.
At that level. Let's not go much deeper.
Okay.
So, Senator Berger, I hope that was okay.
Well, I like the conservatism. I'd just like to enforce that. I think that the department has certainly proven itself to be good business people and making good business decisions. And I think we all depend on that. And while it's necessary that we get as many people into houses and into certainly first-time home buyers. And the reason for that is in our communities, that is a total lift to the economic development of that community. And where people come in and buy homes, particularly that are already built and are there and have been run down, and get into that home and take great pride in it, that's wonderful. You also have a constant revenue source. So it's not like we're risking. You've got the money behind that, and you also have secure mortgages. So I think all of that. I guess the one thing that I would caution you is that we not just get so far into trying to provide that we extend ourselves, or perhaps I should say overextend ourselves. I'll always stay back from what you could have done rather than what you're capable of doing. Because then if we find we go into these, everything has its cycles. We go into one of those cycles, you've never gone all the way to the edge, and I appreciate that. I think one question that I would have, though, is how do people know about you? And I mean that as a very sincere question, because many times what I find in public life, people come to me, and then I can direct them to where I know that they can get help. But where's just the average Oregonian out there who is really living below the poverty line and needs help with housing? They may not know that they can get to you, so how do you fill that gap?
Chair Smith, Senator Verger, great question, and one that we wrestle with at the department, and I think we ask ourselves that almost every day. As I mentioned, we do have loans in 35 counties, and it is delivered through private sector banks and mortgages. So one element of how we get known, if you will, is to sell our program to the private sector bankers and mortgage lenders and tell them the advantage of somebody who comes through their door wanting to become a home buyer who wouldn't qualify under the private bank's programs. We try to sell them on ours and make it easier for the bankers to work with. And so we're constantly updating those tools. We've also, John Gale, our program manager, frequently on the road, and Bob Repine as well, meeting with realtors. So we're looking for new avenues. We've increased some advertising. We didn't used to do much advertising, but we've tried to do that now in a variety of local papers to show people our low rates, below 5%, for example. There's first-time home buyer programs that contribute our staff's time to, particularly John Gale, the program manager, will go out. He's a great spokesman for the program. But I think our housing council as well has made the same point that you made, that we really need to get out and make the department's programs and our name aware, because as you mentioned in your comments, that has been one of the biggest helps to get people out of poverty, is once they get into the home ownership and the housing prices in Oregon increase, you'll see that that's a key factor in getting people to self-sufficiency and out of poverty. So we really do need, we are redoubling our efforts to get the word out, but we still need more, and we still need to do more. So we do have initiatives along those lines.
Perhaps in your marketing efforts, Director Repine, be willing to provide his cell phone number, and we could do that.
He would love to talk about the program, but I don't know if he'd go that far.
Two billboards on I-5, I-84.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I don't say that lightly. I'll bet everybody in this room will remember the first home that they got into that they were going to own. They maybe didn't own it when they moved in, but they planned on owning it. And I well remember mine. And so, but I think what it does for our community, which is, in my opinion, the long vision of where you can have people move into homes and lift an area that might have been more in poverty, or even riding through it, you would know it was low income, and yet home buyers get in there, fix them up, keep the yards, and it's an incentive for everybody to lift. You know, the old saying, all boats rise, yeah. And I think home ownership does that. So I just would caution you that you've been very successful. I think you've really made, obviously, a lot of good decisions along the way. The department has grown, but you've been self-sufficient.
Correct.
In many, many ways. You've provided the funds and kept the engine going. But never go all the way. Always keep back from what you're capable of doing, because that always is. We haven't done that in state government. We don't have a rainy day fund today.
Right.
And so I look at it and wonder, where is the wisdom here that we still don't have anything that is kind of this backup that most of us, the little, you know, sock drawer that people try to keep money aside, and in government we haven't always done that. So,
thank you, Senator. Good point.
Share with the committee how you measured the demand for that additional $500 million.
I'd be happy to do that. We have projections on, and I can get this information to the committee, but we have projections on the program, both in single-family mortgages, in apartment building mortgages that we will add, and as well as potential escrow that we might get, as Ms. Lockwood-McCall mentioned. So we have projections that we do annually over the next And we project over the next 4 to 5 years.
So you and your staff sit down and you say, okay, this is where we've been. Here's the trends.
Right.
Here's what we anticipate.
Exactly right.
Okay.
We make projections on repayments that'll bring down the levels, and as well as new activity that'll bring up. So we do have, I don't have that information in front of me, but we do have detailed projections for all the different categories.
The last question I have, it's in regard to multifamily, and these are probably questions that are interchangeable with future discussion, but I'll ask it now. How do you secure a multifamily loan or a mortgage? Do you take? I know you're gonna take a mortgage. Do you take a uniform commercial code filing on there on rents receivable?
Chair Smith, I'll take a stab at it, although I'm not like a legal expert, but I know we have a security interest in the, I've actually reviewed just recently 4 or 5 documents that typically go with a multi-unit mortgage in relation to another project that I'm working on. So I know we have project use agreements. Ultimately, we have the security interest. I don't know if it's the UCC
document. Do you have
document.
The ability, let me rephrase my question. Do you have the ability to collect rents in the event of a foreclosure?
Yes.
Okay.
So my staff is telling me, yes, we do. Marla says our asset and property management division administrator, and apparently we do.
Okay. My comment following on Senator Berger's that I'm a conservative lender is I would hope that I compliment you. Let me rephrase that. I compliment you on making sure that there's security agreements in place to ensure that in the event of a foreclosure, and unfortunately in this industry those occur, that's the nature of the business, that not only are you able to take to acquire the property, but you're also able to manage it, which I assume includes being able to collect rents and rents receivable. So thank you. All right. Welcome.
Again, through the chair, I just might add one more point. Sort of inevitable, but currently the credit rating that's provided by the national credit ratings for the single-family housing program is higher than the state's credit rating. So that's just one more level of assurity to the senators and the representatives that the program's well managed, and that at least the national rating agencies see it as currently at a higher credit rating, AA2, than the state's own credit rating.
Last question I would have, interest earnings. How much of those are you able to use for administrative versus how much you need to go into escrow?
The Internal Revenue Code limits our interest earnings that we're allowed to keep to 1.125% for our single-family program and 1.5% for our multi-unit program.
Of the total outstanding balance?
It's per bond deal. So, in a way, I suppose ultimately it would be outstanding, okay. But it's per deal. And those earnings pay basically for all the compliance aspects and bond issuance. And so all the different administrative costs that the IRS requires of us in order to run the program within their rules has to pay for that.
Do you anticipate any new FTE requirements? Or are your loan officers going to be managing just a greater portfolio?
I think Mr. Krager is going to talk about that a little bit in the conversation on the next bill you have on the docket. I think for property management, I believe there are some compliance positions that we have requested relative to that, but you'll get into that in the next bill if you don't.
Sure.
That's an acceptable answer.
No problem. We appreciate the testimony that you have provided on House Bill 2052. I'm going to ask if anyone in the audience would like to come up and testify on House Bill 2052. If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2052 and now invite Mr. John Donovan.
Thank you.
And Paul Vanderfalker. If you gentlemen could come up and testify in Senate Bill 5515.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome. You could just introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, sir. My name is John Donovan. I'm Development Director for Albany Helping Hand Shelter.
I'm Paul Vanderwalker, and I was homeless, and I got better. And I'm here to testify on the behalf of Praying Hands.
All right. Welcome.
Thank you. We really appreciate the chance to visit with you. We're talking a little bit about the impact of what you folks do that have helped us so critically because 5 years ago we actually started working with Albany Helping Hands, became a nonprofit 501c3, and we took over from a small church in the community which was doing amazing work with no resources and helping people to improve their lives. And they agreed to become community-wide and work with a lot more folks. And in the past 5 years, we've been able to add a lot to our resources. We rehabbed an old building, which was the only building which we could lease in the entire community. And we've been also able to add staff to help us be able to do a lot more with career planning, goal setting, and work on these areas. And right now, we're completing rehab of two wonderful buildings, which will enable us to be in excellent physical facilities and to provide more resources and provide a lot more help to the folks in our community that we're serving. So you were a critical piece of that. 5 years ago, we received the first SHAP dollars, which, you know, in and of itself was $36,000, but it was a huge piece of our start. And today our budget per year is about $170,000 a year for the entire operation. But it was so critical that we just wanted to come up and thank you and tell you that you're getting a lot of value for your dollar.
Well, we appreciate that. I know Senator Morris wanted to be here today, but he's kind of a big dog in this process, and he's out working on some legislation, so we appreciate that. I do have to point out to this committee, just on the handout they provided us, you can tell they're doing a very good job because they're breaking down their budgets to the simplest component, which is the day, and businesses that understand their daily cash flow understand their weekly, they understand their monthly, and they understand their annual, and so I compliment you on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for?
Well, I'd just like to make a comment, Mr. Chairman, that it is always very enlightening and satisfying to me to see people like you that are concerned about people that have no home, have no family, have made poor decisions maybe that have made them there, but you're non-judgmental and give a handout. And that's really what this life is all about.
I would like to just briefly turn this over to my ally here, Paul. Actually, I met Paul 5 years ago, and we were just starting to rehab this old building we're in now, and thankfully we'll be out of it at the end of June. But Paul was helping us rehab the building, and I asked him if he'd like a ride home, and he said, sure. So I took him home, and he was living in the cemetery in a tent in the dead of winter. And I was floored. That's where he was living. But he helped us with that rehab and then became part of our shelter management staff. And then today he has his own apartment, and he has his own place, and he continues to help and volunteer and give back to the community. So I just hope he could tell his story a little bit to you about the experience of a person who has come through the entire process.
Welcome.
Hey, I came from Marietta, Arizona, hitchhiking. And there's some rough days and some good days, you know, but finally I ended up in Albany, Oregon. I didn't know nobody, didn't know where to go. I found a cemetery, so I went down and I met another homeless person, so I said, come on, we set up your tent, and that's where it was, so I stayed there that night, and he said, come on, we'll go get some coffee and donuts. Okay, fine, where? I said, I ain't got no money. So you don't need any. So then I ended up down at Albany Praying Hands, got coffee and donuts, and met a few people. Got started. I said, well, you know, I didn't care for it at first, you know. I said, well, I'm going back to the tent. So I go back and got to thinking. I'd done it 2-3 days. The fourth day, I made up my mind. I said, I got to do something because this is getting too bad. Rainy, cold, and wasn't eating good, and so I was drinking good. And so so I went to for help with Praying Hands. I met Pastor Bailey, Grace, a few other people there, and I said, I need help. And he said, all you got to do is reach your hands out, and we'll do what we can for you. And from that day on, they did. They done everything. And I got my own place in, let's see, what was that guy's name? Bill?
Mm-hmm.
Bill? And then finally I got myself working into the kitchen, cooking. And I liked that pretty well. And then I got into maintenance. And then I got into paint. And I mean, they really helped me out. And I figured I could give my time back to them for what they done for me. And I was very thankful. We went to church. So that's the first time I went to church, probably 20 years. So I got started. And then now I got my own place. I'm on Social Security. I'm 65 years old. So things have really jumped up for me. So if anybody's homeless and they want help, go to Praying Hands, because they will help you. And never turn you down.
Well, thank you so much for coming, and may God bless you. We truly appreciate your testimony today. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
We're going to call...
Mr. Chairman, that was a great story.
Yeah, it is.
You know, we get in such a rush around here and talk about the few dollars we have, but it still tells us that as a state, we're doing some good things.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, thank you.
We're all still... Mm-hmm. We're all just people.
Yeah,
right. Absolutely. Mr. Blatt and John, why don't you come on up as well? We'll have both of you come up at the same time. Welcome.
Well, that's a hard act to follow. Someday I got to figure this out. I always seem to follow people like that in this testimony, and it kind of.
I think Greg set you up, don't you think?
Yeah, right. I did. I used to in one of my jobs. I managed about 100 people across the country, and we'd bring them together, and we'd bring an inspirational speaker in at lunch. And I always said, you know, the inspirational speaker got everybody fired up, and it was my job to tell them where the bathrooms were.
You can just give your name for the record.
Yes. My name is John Blatt. I'm with the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations. And I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 515 today. And we're in support of Senate Bill 515. The most important things to us in that are the Housing Trust Fund grants are included in there. And we think that it will maintain the department at a level of responsiveness that will enable us to continue to do development. My members are divided into two groups. I have about 40 members who are nonprofits who develop affordable housing all over the state, and the other 60 members that we have are partners of theirs and people who care about affordable housing. My membership together owns about 10,000 units of affordable housing across the state. We house a little over 25,000 people every night in that housing. So we have done quite a bit, and we could not have done it without the department, and we could not do it and could not complete the development process without the department with sufficient staffing to be responsive to changes during the development process, to last-minute things that happen. And so we think this budget provides that, and so we're in support of that. Rather than go through kind of line by line on them, yesterday there was a comment that the department had a lot of programs. And my members, in addition to doing housing, they all have to do something else. You can't just be a houser to be a member of my organization. You have to do something else for your community, something else for the residents that live there. And a lot of those other programs that the department has are the kind of programs that we also deliver to the residents. One of the most important is probably the Individual Development Account program. That is a program where we bring in people who are residents of our units or just residents of the areas where we do work, and they set a savings goal, and we match that their savings to reach that goal. The goals can be to buy a home, to start a small business, to do job training, or to get more education. And so we help them set that savings goal. We help them learn about budgeting, and we give them financial we call it financial literacy training. It's basically teaching them about the financial world. We teach them everything from why is it important to use a bank instead of a check cashing agency, why if your employer offers a 401k program or something like that, why would you want to participate in it. And we do basic introductions to things at the advanced end. We do basic introductions to things like what is the risk-reward trade-off for investing in stocks and other things. We don't get into financial advising, but try to give people a sense of the very complicated financial world that they're operating within, and what they can do to make their dollar go a little farther, and how to plan for the future. And we do that all through this program. We call it the IDA program, and it really gives them an incentive to set a goal and work toward it. My members are getting more and more involved in home ownership housing. It is a very important element of what's out there, and as an option for people for their housing. And Oregon, unfortunately, is actually declining in home ownership rate compared to the rest of the country. In 2000, we were 42nd in the nation in affordable housing. The latest survey that came out using 2003 data has us at 44th. In the nation.
Can you interrupt you really quick? Senator Johnson.
Are you tracking any trends that might indicate a pattern of why? And things immediately pop to my mind, regulatory problems, land use, access to credit.
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, we have not tracked it directly. What we see out there generally is there is a increasing differential between the average wage paid and the cost of housing. Mm-hmm. And so housing is becoming more concentrated at the upper income levels. And exactly why that is, we haven't tracked that here in Oregon. We actually are talking to Portland State University about helping us identify some of those problems so that we can figure out how to put together a home ownership program.
I think that's a great idea. The Institute for Metropolitan Studies at Portland State tracks all kinds of demographic information in a 5-county area.
Mm-hmm.
I know that would give you data for this concentrated, urban, dense metropolitan area and might not speak to some of the issues in central and eastern Oregon. But I think trying to identify what some of those bars are so that you could come into the legislature and actually present these factors contribute to the lack of availability of affordable housing and ask policymakers to address those. You can't get anything else put together in your life. I mean, this gentleman that just spoke has got to be Exhibit A. You can't get anything else together if you don't have a place. And to try to establish what those bars are, I think, might guide decision makers.
Well, if I have my way, I'll be back here in 2 years with just a plan like that. So.
Cool.
That's our goal. We think it's a very important thing to do.
Really quick, while we have a pause here, the IDAs, the incentive program, how are those funded?
Those are actually funded through donations, and there is a state tax credit that you can get in addition to the charitable donation that you get for the donation. There's a state tax credit that helps us kind of make that a better-looking donation than other kinds of charitable donations.
The point I want to raise on this is you're dealing with a group of folks who are probably most likely skeptical about state government.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to make sure that that program is able to have longevity, if you will, to make sure it keeps its promise. So if someone's coming in and is beginning to make investments and beginning to go through a process, beginning to save money, that it's not cut off midway through and all of a sudden it's, well, this is gone now.
And that's a very good point. What we've done is we've taken a very cautious approach, and the city's taken a cautious approach. We actually don't actually offer the accounts to anyone until we have the money in hand, so that we know so we know how many accounts we can offer before we even start. It has kept the program fairly small. I mean, I think we're about 300 accounts right now, but we've done it. We've been cautious about it just for that exact reason. We didn't want anyone to come into the program, save toward their goal, and say, well, can you wait 60 days to buy your house or whatever it is you're trying to do?
Well, just really quick for the committee's sake, I have a personal situation in which my mother-in-law was working with folks, not this program, mm-hmm. a different one. But the state of Oregon, even though it had nothing to do with this department, ended up taking a black eye because there was a federal program that had folks coming in working towards home ownership, had people literally jumping through hoops, and there are people who are committed to getting their first home, and about two-thirds of the way through, it was cut and said, well, we're sorry, federal funding for this has ended. And, people don't distinguish between a nonprofit, the state, and the federal government.
No.
And
yeah.
Somehow we took a black eye on that.
Right.
So, anyway.
The final comment I wanted to make was really about what are the economic impacts of this. A couple years ago, we had someone study our portfolio of units and look at what was the economic impact that those created. And what they found is between 1990 and 2002 that the housing that we developed supported 12,200 full-time jobs over that period of time, and that we paid about almost $400 million in wages to construction and construction-related trades. So about $34 million a year in wages out to in construction. What we also did is we studied our rent structure, compared it to market, and we also found out that the ongoing benefit of this housing at that point, 2 years ago, where we were saving people about $24 million a year in the form of lower rents. And that $24 million a year translates into about 833 jobs that get supported by the additional savings that's going into people's pockets. And we know from studies that when lower-income families save, get more money, they actually spend it up until they reach a certain level, and then they start to save. So we know that money is going back into local economies. And with that, I'll take any other questions.
Thank you very much, Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Do you track at all, or maybe Habitat does, or are you aware of any studies that track from the time a person has a place, what their income potential, how it, in Mr. Repine's head is going up and down, that's a good thing. and maybe he could answer. What I'm trying to figure out is someone gets their first Habitat for Humanity house or a house, and 5 years hence, their income level has increased. Good things have come from the result of having a place.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, for the record, I'm Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing Community Services. Two answers to that I'd like to share with you. One, Habitat really does a good job of tracking the successes of their partners in their housing. And I would say categorically that people who enter into the Habitat housing, if nothing, just for the sheer economics of the leverage they get by coming into that house and the stability they get, their life changes, opportunities, jobs, everything advances dramatically. And I'm sure I can get that information from the state Habitat organization, at least a profile of that. For more of a local, at a local level, on just even rental housing affordability and how it affects people's lives, Jerry Croft, who was here yesterday, who is the director of the Marion County Housing Authority, is one of the few county housing authorities that does an annual tracking of people entering their housing based on their incomes and based on the number of service modules or components that they still need. They might be on state subsidies, food stamps, other state-funded resources. And in the first year, he tracks that and finds, and again, the numbers I won't try to quote because I think I wouldn't do injustice, but he tracks how much money more they're making income-wise, how much assistance programs they're no longer taking. So it really is a dramatic profile in a year's time of getting somebody into that stabilizing housing, how it improves their quality of life, both financially and as a family unit, and how it actually reduces the amount of federal or state subsidies that we have to put into it. So it really is a win-win at when they do get to that stabilization.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that, given all the other demands on your time, it's not worthwhile, I think, to try to get that data right away. But over time, if you could share that with the legislature, I think it's a great idea where you could actually see where the state services begin to no longer be required and fall off, and also see if there's some trend there. It is all I'm really looking for, the underpinnings to bolster the case for why affordable, safe housing, whether it's rental or owned, it makes such a difference in people's lives.
And again, I don't. The information I think is pretty readily available. I can get it pretty
great. Quick. If it's not burdensome to get it, that'd be great.
Colleagues, just really quick, where we are is we have a little bit more public testimony, and then we're going to need about an hour to get through phase two. So I'm going to kind of keep pushing us along. With that, welcome, Mr. McCauley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm John McCauley here representing the tree fruit growers. These are the fruit growers in the Mid-Columbia area, Hood River, Wasco counties, in eastern Oregon, Umatilla, Milton Freewater area, and in southern Oregon, Jackson County. I'm here just briefly to say good things about the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit Program that is overseen by the department. This is a critical program for the people that I represent, and they've been the beneficiaries of the good work done by the department in this area. I have to tell you that whenever it was 6 years ago, I think three sessions ago, a change was made to move the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit Program from or OSHA, where it had been housed for many years, to this department. And there was some concern on the part of my growers that they might not get as much attention if it were in the big housing department compared to or OSHA, because farm worker housing is considered a workplace. And so there was a lot of interaction between or OSHA and the growers, some good and some bad, but interaction nonetheless. But I have to say that it has been a very positive experience. The department has done significant outreach efforts talking to producers about the availability of this program. They have recognized the unique nature of grower-provided housing, and we are very pleased with the efforts that they have made. And I just wanted to put that on the record that this is a very important thing that they do, and they do it very well.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
There was some superior press on the TV about a particular complex that just opened. And I'm sorry that I can't tell you where. I came in just on the end of it, but it was very attractive housing. And I talked about the value of this now subsidized farm worker housing, health, safety, well-being of the folks that live there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Nice, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Good report, huh?
That's right. That's right. Mr. Beam. And I'm going to invite any other folks who would like to come up and testify on Senate Bill 5515. We have about 5 minutes remaining. Welcome. Really quick before we begin, is there anyone else out there that wants to testify? No. Okay, here's what I'm going to do. To be fair, I'm going to give each of you about 2.5 minutes. That way we'll start right at 2 p.m. moving into Senate Bill 5515.
So. Mr. Chairman, my name is David Beam. I'm an advocate for disability people from Marion County. Now, some disability people are on the waiting list in Marion County, and some of them can't get served on housing because a lot of them can't read and write in the state. But my program is I'm trying to get a national program in the state of Oregon for a drop-in center for each county for the ones that's not getting served in the state. Every legislature every 2 years said they're going to do something for special needs populations. They're not doing what they said they're going to do. Now, my program would be 24 hours round the clock to each county for all the housing. And you got a lot of disability people are abused and can't get services in the housing area. My idea is each county and state police and each services in the county should be looked at under the governor budget. This services could be better in the community, would be housing for them, it would cut down a lot of crime in the state, and I think this housing should be more funding for this good program. It should be done as soon as possible under governor budget for housing.
Thank you. Well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to ask you to come visit me at my office. And why don't you and I sit down and take a few minutes and let's go through this, and so that way we can get into more detail on it.
Okay.
Would you be willing to do that with me?
Yes. And okay. This is my assistant, David Winter. He will tell you more about what the problems are.
Terrific. You could just introduce yourself for the record.
All right. D.C. Winters and I am assisting David Beam and dealing with assessing and figuring out where the appropriate way to deal with the various issues. Because housing is one of the key components when they're fleeing from domestic violence and abuse and life-threatening neglect and homelessness. And currently there is no place where a person, well, 2 years ago when Beam was helping a blind lady that was both deaf and mute, that she could hear a little bit, baby crying and things like that, but effective communication wasn't there, and her only way was communicating was touch, sign language. The local crisis agency would not help her, and if there was such a person today in Salem, there is not a place that would be able to help her. And so the housing issues, the crisis housing issues of shelter and those kind of issues where they get into, because in this case, the woman's husband and father of the baby just simply left her downtown and drove away, and that was it. And she was in downtown Salem for almost 2 weeks before Beam was directed to her, to the Rapaz map. So there's got to be some programs, and so we need to discuss those.
Would you be willing to join Mr. Beam in visiting with me?
It's House Bill 2702, just in the works, but it doesn't directly address housing issues.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the thing that occurs to me in hearing this testimony and what I've heard here is the sum total of what I know. So forgive me if I am way off the mark here. But it seems to me that what you might want to think about doing is instead of trying to start new systems, figure out how to beef up the systems that exist, that already have services in place. I don't see the money being available to replicate 36 different drop-in centers in counties around the state, if that's what the plan is. And I know of many fine not-for-profits that are doing excellent work right now, and we might want to think of a mechanism to strengthen those not-for-profits that are in place instead of creating more systems, a veneer that's very thin and spread over a wide area versus deepening the excellent work of not-for-profits that's happening now.
I don't discount that there are nonprofits doing what you're saying, but when it comes to the special needs people with severe disability, Down syndrome and other cognitive disabilities, most of those people have been, statistics show that somewhere between 90 to 99% are abused by the time they turn to age 18. And there has to be a willingness by nonprofit agencies to deal with extremely hard to serve clientele. And unfortunately, our research shows that they're not open to serving those people. It would be nice to think that they were.
Senator Johnson.
This is the last comment I'll make on this. Respectfully, I will go back to my original premise and to say you ought to pick out a handful of them regionalized not-for-profits that you could work with, figure out how to strengthen their core programs, figure out a transportation mechanism that links them all. We can't have facilities, we just can't afford it, in every single city to deal with every single potentiality. I'd rather deepen the capacity and figure out a cogent transportation and communication network than to try to reinvent the wheel, it seems a little.
Please.
I love what's telling you. My program would cut down a lot of crime in this state. You don't go for this. You're going to go have more crime in this middle in each county. And how are you going to deal with that problem?
Well, let's do this, because I think you have a very, very valid issue. And I'm willing to put some time into this, if you're willing to put some time into
this. Yes, I would.
But there's a couple other folks in here who are going to also be asked to step up to the table and meet with me. Mr. Kinney, I'm going to ask you, and Mr. Blatt, I'm going to ask you to come meet with me. And we're going to sit down, and we're going to walk through this issue, because I think you have a very valid issue. I think you have a very valid point. I do not know the solution, but I'm willing to work with you to find one.
And I'd like to see this get on the floor in the House Senate.
I can't promise you that.
But I think
I'll give you the necessary time to work through this, because it deserves it.
I think each governor said they're going to do this for disability people, and then turn them against them.
You know what we need to do? And then we're going to move on. We need to put the best package together we can, looking at existing resources, because our governor cares about all Oregonians. I know he does. And what we need to do as legislators, and I need your help to do it, is to figure out how to put that best package together. Now, I can't carry all this, but I do have the ability to get some folks to come help us put this together, and I'm willing to work with you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you,
gentlemen.
Thank you.
Chair Smith and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank, and I have distributed to you a page which I provided to you before, which really talks about what we're able to do in leveraging those dollars that are made available. And I really want to highlight the over 3 million hours of volunteer hours that really come out to the community as a result of what the Oregon Food Bank does all across the state. And I want to mention that oftentimes the food pantry is the safe place that people come and really talk about what their problems are. And so that's our real connection, I think, with the community service part of the housing and community service, is that there are linkages then to community action agencies. There are linkages to the local school district all over the place. That so just as I sometimes am a messenger for those people in these halls, in the local community, often it's the people who really volunteer their hours at their food pantries. But it is critical that we have some of that kind of support that comes from the Housing and Community Service Department. Food Bank is part of the Housing Alliance because we ask questions. People give us information. Affordable housing is one of those top things. And there were some questions about some of the values of providing housing, and one of them wasn't mentioned, and that is performance of children in school. And you get stable housing and stable families, and you're going to have children who are going to be able to be part of some advanced training, whether it's higher ed or VOC, someday. And so that is one of the values. But I really want to stress that what the department does in terms of providing special needs housing, and they do, what they do in affordable housing for all generations is critical to having a stable economy, because, again, there is a real strong linkage. And so I hope that somehow you are going to be able to add some funds to that housing trust fund. The resolution I gave you, some of you remember working with Jerry Beverly. This is the last thing that Jerry and I did together, was this resolution. And so you have performance measures. Why don't you use this as a way of measuring what you're doing to make sure that it's now now it's 6 years, but you need to get at it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that wonderful testimony. Really quick before you leave, Senator Verger.
Mr. Chairman, I want to just insert a thought here because I'm very supportive of providing housing. But I think we need to somehow come back now with a little bit of balance. It's important because children do perform better, and I agree with Ellen, but we've got to somehow show people when they have a family that there is a responsibility that they then take on, that they provide as well as they can the environment for their family. And so going back to my comment earlier in the week, I'd like to see them work yourself out of a job, and that is teaching people to be self-reliant, self-sufficient, and being accountable. And I think that when you help people get in a home, that's the first step to kind of push them into the river so they can swim. And I just don't want us to go too far in what we need to do for other people. I believe in giving people a start, but I also remember when I taught my children to ride a bicycle, I ran behind and held on, and then I let go. And then they discovered they were pedaling all on their own, and they never had to have me hold them again. And so I think we really need to keep that in mind with all of our programs.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, you look at the enabling legislation for the Hunger Relief Task Force, which, again, was a Beverly Low contribution. And we actually, at that time, had hoped we'd be out of the business by now. Okay. And I'd say that particularly because so many of the volunteers at the food bank are my age, we really are working to, and you ought to look at the gardens around many of the food pantries, the gleaners. There are a lot of things that are happening. And I had a mother who used to teach people how to make soup.
Thank you very much. Rick, you're up. What do we have here? 55 minutes. Atif, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rick Crager, Chief Financial Officer for the Department. I guess it would be important for me to put on the record, as you brought up yesterday, that Jack Kinney and myself do report to Bob Repine. So I just wanted to make sure. You know, he's been looking at me awfully funny since yesterday, seeing if I'm trying to pass get a faster passing. So I thought I better put that on the record. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask our presentation document to maybe dust that off. I think you all have your copies of the presentation document to start with. We're going to refer back to that. And my objective here today is to get into the essential and policy packages of the department's budget. Before I start, and Satish hit on this a little bit yesterday, the budget structure for Oregon Housing Community Services changed in 2005-2007. In the past, we'd had one program budget, and it was just kind of one large sum of dollars. And what we tried and attempted to do to provide more information, better information to the legislature, is to split that out. And I do want to compliment Mr. Potier and Monica Brown for helping us out on that. So I know that was quite a task for them as well as our staff. But referring to pages 33 through 37, I just wanted to set this up briefly to talk about the different program units that we do have. Program Unit 100 is referring to our energy and weatherization programs. As we talked before, that's $93.5 million worth of dollars, which includes our low-income weatherization programs, our energy assistance, as well as our energy-rated homes of Oregon. Again, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to set this up just so that it makes it easier when we talk through the policy package and you know what numbers we're referring to. On page 34, Program Unit number 200 is our self-sufficiency emergency assistance programs. This encompasses the homeless programs, our food assistance programs, as well as our rental assistance programs, and that's $133.7 million worth of our budget. Page 35 is the community capacity building programs. That's Program Unit 300 that would be referred to in the presentation. $28.7 million. This includes our community development block grant dollars, community incentive fund, a community services block grant, community development block grant, community services block grant, and then our MDPO, our manufactured dwelling park community relations program. Hope I got that right. Program Unit 400, page 36, that's our homeownership and affordable rental housing. That's the biggest chunk of our budget. As you see, $2.2 billion worth. Again, most of that is related to our debt service for our single-family residential loan program that you'll see at the top. So, again, this is the majority of the department's budget, and the majority is non-limited. And then finally, page 37 is our program outreach and accountability. This is $14.2 million. This is essentially the staffing, the indirect staff related to information technology, related to administration and account and some of our compliance work. So that's the smallest portion of all the packages. But again, Mr. Chairman, this just sort of sets up all the packages, and now I'm going to move you over to page 40, where we will get into discussion of all of the packages. And what you'll see in each of these pages as we go through, you'll see the numbers that are listed down at the bottom. And one thing I just want to point out.
I'm in the wrong tab. Would you please direct me to the right page 40?
I'm going to turn to Monica to help us.
It's not in this book.
Right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it would be part of your presentation materials that was sent out to you in phase one.
Thank you.
I was on the wrong page.
I wasn't in the right book.
I apologize. No, you're fine. You're fine. It's our responsibility, and I know I didn't bring my book.
I think if you just talk about the content rather than the page numbers, we can follow along.
Okay.
Yeah. There you go.
Mr. Chairman, I'm very sorry. I apologize. I assume everybody was looking at what I was looking at. So.
Remember, we're legislators.
We forgot our book.
Okay. I will not refer to the page numbers anymore. Again, I will start. These packages that I'm going to present in the essentials and policies, they're going to be the majority of them. There's a lot of positions, to be exact, 25.37 FTE. Of those 25.37 FTE that were coming to request, 1.87 is brand new. The rest of these positions have been approved in previous legislative sessions. They've been limited duration in our budget. In fact, 14 of those positions have actually been approved since October of 2000 in an emergency board. So this is the fourth time around on that particular package. So when we put our packages together in this new structure, it was a little awkward because you had some under the old model that you were putting into the new model. So I tried to present this package by package to make as most sense as possible. If there are questions as I go through, please just stop me.
Senator Johnson.
I have one. Let me just make sure that I understand this. These were limited duration positions that you're now in this policy package asking to create as full-time, as non-limited.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, that's correct. We're asking the current limited duration to be approved as permanent positions.
Thank you. Permanent. That was the word I was grappling for. The piece that I'm not sure, and thank you, Senator Berger, for sharing the presentation documents, the piece that I'm wondering about, and I'm musing about it more with staff and the committee because we've had this conversation in other instances, is in moving those from non-limited to permanent positions, whether or not they are tied to any performance measures. When you first came in and asked for them, you came before a panel, not unlike this, and said we need these limited duration positions, and they were granted, and they were going to do certain things. Mm-hmm. And ideally, there would be some deliverables or some evidence that they did what they said they were going to do back when you first asked for them before they were converted to permanent. And I haven't heard or seen in the material, and I'm sure it's here, I just am too dense to find it, make the connection for me, that they performed as anticipated when you got them the first time as limited duration.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, our performance measurements that we have as a department, I think they, you know, they're very programmatic driven. I think a good example is our HUD contract administration unit. They essentially provide services to 171 different projects throughout Oregon. That's a contract that we have with HUD to go out and make sure that the property is maintained appropriately. And if we do that work correctly, we are awarded through payment, and in addition, an incentive. It's an incentive contract. If you're going out doing the work, making sure that everything's in compliance. I can't point out specifically performance measure here, but within the department itself, we have commonly met that particular incentive as a department.
Mr. Chair?
Please.
I don't mean to be argumentative, but the point that I'm trying to make is on the example that you gave. You're supposed to go out and inspect X number of HUD projects. Maybe you can do it with five people and still keep the flow of federal money going. Maybe if those five worked smarter, faster, better, you could do it with three and still keep the money going. I'm trying to figure out, are there efficiencies in this that can be specifically tied to performance measures? For example, we had an agency come before this panel the other day and ask for additional caseworkers to manage a backlog. And ideally, then you bring the number of waiting days down that the folks that are being serviced have to wait to get service from the agency. And it would be very easy to say if we had five more people, we could bring the backlog down from 18 months to 6 days or whatever it is. I'm obviously making this up. But I'm trying to correlate some demonstration of the value of converting limited duration to permanent tied to something.
May I?
Please. You could just introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Marla Slaver. I'm the Division Administrator of the Asset Property Management Division of Oregon Housing. Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, if I may, I'd like to at least try to bring this into context a little bit and try to answer your question.
That'd be great.
The HUD contract administration section that we put in place 5 years ago was the first incentive-based fee, performance-based fee contract that HUD ever entered into with any of the states. And we literally have 17 performance-based things that we must meet in order to get our fee. And if we meet or exceed those specific performance-based requirements, we not only get our base fee, but we get an incentive fee. And so we are very, this contract and those people that administer this contract, it is very, very much tied to responsibilities, time frames, the way that the job is done, and we've been very successful at that. And if I may talk just a minute about the amount of people there to do it. We have just received, we've done this particular contract for 5 years now. We've just been told, and I have a letter here from HUD that's indicating they are going to now move this into an additional 10-year contract. So we can see that it's been really a pretty permanent part of our business and HUD's business. And one of the things that they are, and they indicate this in the letter, that we've been so successful because we have it, we do have it funded with the right amount of people to do the work. One of their requirements is that they like to have each compliance officer complete about 40 to 45 apartment communities each year in their portfolios, and this particular unit is really, the funding for it and the staffing is based on a requirement from HUD. So hopefully that'll help a little bit.
It helps a lot. I understand it completely. But what I'm trying to figure out is you've got 14 limited duration positions. Where's the break point? Could you do a 10? Could you do it with 9? I know if you had 47 that you could probably discharge it. I'm just trying to figure out, is 14 the right number? Are you asking your people to do as much as they possibly can?
Believe me, we struggle every day with being able to get the work done, and I think this is we can attest to the fact that the success of this particular program has showed us that it is staffed appropriately, and furthermore, the federal agency we're working for, HUD, believes that we have staffed it appropriately, and one of the, you know. You say, well, if you had 40 people, you could do it quicker. Well, probably not, right, because there's certain things that have to be done each day, each month, sometimes on a quarterly basis and an annual basis. One of the things that we did this last year to help us to keep from having to ask for more positions, we completely changed, for instance, our inspection criteria. We used to go out, literally, inspect all of the apartment communities with a pad and a pencil. We would come back and type up the report. Now, with the technology the way it is, we have a very small personal digital assistant that we're able to use, that we literally point and click with all the criteria that's in an inspection. We come back, do that, we're able to place it in the cradle, And it completes the report for us. And that literally has reduced, in my estimation, at least two positions that we would have had to been, quite frankly, asking for in addition to these.
Last question. How many properties do you look at a year?
We have them divided between sections. The Housing Programs Management section, who does all of our bond and all of our tax credit and all of our grant projects, there's 626 projects, over 26,000 units, and in the HUD contract administration section, that's the communities that we do not we don't hold any loans on. We strictly do contract work for the federal government. Is 171 projects,
so
and a little over 6,000 units.
621 plus 171.
Correct.
So, for rounding purposes, call it 800 projects. I was just trying to figure out with 14 people, and if they're looking at an average of 40. You see what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, I do. And you will see, actually, this gets a little bit deeper into the issue, but on the HUD contract administration section that has all the limited duration positions that we are now asking to go to permanent, HUD is telling us that it's staffed correctly at about 40 to 45 projects per compliance officer. Unfortunately, on the housing programs management section that really does all the monitoring and the compliance, the bond compliance, regulatory compliance, those compliance officers are carrying about a portfolio of about 65 projects each.
That makes my math work.
Yeah. So they are carrying a much higher amount of properties per portfolio. Unfortunately, we just don't have the amount of people to really bring it down to what HUD believes we should have.
I want to follow up, but go ahead.
I lied. One more. And so I presume that over a certain period of time, you get a fairly large investment in the training and local knowledge of these folks, and they know the properties, and they now with their PDAs can do it faster, better, smarter. Is the limited duration having a chilling effect on your ability to recruit the right kind of folks to do this work?
It's very, very difficult for us to do that because you're right. This is a process. You cannot go to school. There is not a college class or real estate class that you can take that will make you be a compliance officer. So it's a very, very, takes a long period of time to teach people how to do this very specialized job. And it's very, very difficult, unfortunately, at the rate of pay that we're able to pay them, and now with the benefits that have been reduced due to our budget crisis, it's very difficult to retain good employees. And as a matter of fact, on our HUD contract administration contract, where the limited duration positions we're asking for permanently, one of the things that HUD looks at relative to our performance is our ability to keep our compliance officers and our employees.
Thank you. I quit, Mr. Chair.
Senator Berger.
Mr. Chair, the only thing that bothers me about all of this is that I noticed through your next policy package, you're just asking for more and more, all of these limited positions to be permanent positions. So if I were on the e-board and you came again and said, I need these positions for limited positions, I wouldn't buy it. I would say what you want is limited positions that you're going to come back now and ask me to make permanent. So try to dispel my suspicion here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger.
Been here too long.
I appreciate that. To be frank, at eBoard, we asked for the positions to be permanent in the beginning. They would not allow us to have permanent positions because they were concerned that it was a new contract, that it may not work out. This is a new way of doing business for the federal government and, quite frankly, for the states. And this is a federal mandate throughout the United States. So there's state agencies throughout the United States that have these particular work units. But we were told by eBoard that we could not have permanent positions and they would be limited. And as the work has continued each year, we've asked at each subsequent session such as this that they become permanent, and we've been turned down. We are hoping now, with the assurance from HUD and a letter stating such, that we are going to have at least another 10-year contract, that we're hoping that those could become permanent. And quite frankly, if after 10 years the contract goes away, the work is no longer there, we have no jobs for them. And those people understand that. If they're limited duration positions or they're permanent positions, quite frankly, we would have to lay them off because the work would be gone.
That's a more reassuring scenario if you asked for permanent in the beginning and it was the e-board.
Yes,
that is
correct.
Gave you limited.
Yeah. Right. Let's go Senator Carter, then Senator Johnson.
Are these are federal dollars, and how much is it? How much is the total amount?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, these are actually fee for services. Basically, we have a contract. HUD has come in and said we will contract with the Oregon Housing and Community Services to pay you. So we treat it as other fund. It's not like a federal grant that you traditionally see. So it's a fee for services.
And so all of these employees are not state employees as a result of general fund dollars, but as a result of other funds.
That is correct.
And you're just hiring them as for the duration of the program.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, the way it works with limited duration, we can hire them essentially through the biennium, and then, of course, we have to come back to get reapproval
right,
for them.
But you're not asking for permanent employees for the state of Oregon for future general fund dollars. You're asking for limited duration become permanent for the duration of these dollars that come about as a result of federal government.
That is exactly right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
So then what does this fix? These folks know, if the idea here is to make them permanent so that you can recruit a stable, competent workforce, but they know that the duration could be only 10 years, what difference does it make?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I can tell you that I've been a public servant for 7 years, and I came into this agency as a compliance officer in a limited duration position. It's a very, very, even though all of us know that if our work goes away, we have an opportunity to be laid off. If the work goes away, there's an opportunity that we could be laid off. But I can tell you it's very, very difficult. And I had a very, very good job that paid very good dollars. It was a very difficult decision for me to make to come into state government knowing that at the end of the biennium, my position may go away. It's really almost more psychological than anything, because literally these employees are given a letter each year that says, my job ends on June 30th of whatever year, 2005. I believe it's really more psychological than anything else. The idea that they're going to have, quote, permanent positions is really almost more psychologically soothing than anything else. And quite frankly, in the letter that I've received from HUD, obviously they believe so as well, because they have been in support of these positions going from limited duration positions to permanent positions.
Let's do this. Colleagues, we're down to 33 minutes, and Monica's very good at reminding me, Rick, you have a lot of stuff to go through.
Mr. Chairman, I guess that was a key to talk fast, right?
Get her moving.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess for the purposes of moving this along, the essential packages for the department, and I'll just jump right in. We, as standard with most state agency, has what is called a non-PICS, personal service adjustments. The majority of this is related to pension contributions that are required. That's about $734,000 increase, the majority of that going from other funds, and about $149,000 from federal funds. So that's pretty standard. Again, primarily the pension service cost, as well as vacancy factors. Real quickly, phase out, another standard essential package is we have several things that we need to phase out of our budget. One of those is a one-time cost related to the backfill of other funds. As many of you may recall, there was a legislative request to transfer some of the department's housing finance fund for homeless programs last biennium. That was a one-time transfer, and essentially the phase out is backing that back out. Other funds paid for it last time, and basically that's backing out, and in terms of phasing in, we're restoring the general fund portion of that. So that was $820,000. Again, that was other funds supported for a homeless program last biennium, and we're requesting that to be restored back to general fund for this biennium. In addition, in terms of phase out, and we'll, and Satish and I will talk a little bit more about this. Well, I guess we could talk about it in terms of right now, since you've already given your presentation, but is the HOPWA program. This is currently we have 2.5 FTE, again, limited duration positions. We were requesting those as limited duration positions, and that was going to be a phase in. But as Satish spoke to yesterday, we are requesting a transfer of that program to the Department of Human Services. And I think in Mr. Apadie's presentation, he provided a spreadsheet that showed the transfer of that program and the adjustments that would be needed. I think we have worked diligently with DHS and feel that the program would be more appropriately administered. It's very direct client services, where we are not a direct client service agency, and I think it will be much more effective within that particular program. Lastly, in terms of a phase-in, we have one other position. We call it the ADDI, which is the American American Dream Down Payment Assistance Initiative. This was a presidential initiative that occurred in 2003-2005 where there was additional $900,000 added to our budget for down payment assistance. This position was needed to essentially administer that, to make sure that down payment assistance, but I wanted to add into that that the dollars also allowed this position to assist us a great deal with our regional housing centers that we have been working very hard on. So this position we are requesting, it was established as a limited duration in 2003-2005 administrative through the Department of Administrative Services, and we're asking that to be a permanent position. We see the, even though the initiative is a three-year initiative, we, down payment assistance is a part of the agency program through our homeownership assistance as well as our residential loan program, and then regional housing centers will be for the long term. We will continue to operate that.
Can you send me information on that program?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to provide that. Mr. Chairman, last, in terms of the central package, this is the standard inflation package, and total cost for the agency is $270,000. Again, this package is related to the price adjustments and inflation that for the department, and relatively standard in terms of the request. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to jump right into the policy packages, and I'm try to move through it as quickly as I can. The first is a revenue shortfall package, and this is related to the low-income rental housing fund. And the dollars that we get for this, part of the money that we get, this I should say, is from interest earnings on security deposits made by landlords. In the past, it was required that the interest earnings on this pass to the low-income rental housing fund. There was a change in the past that made that optional. And as time has gone along, we've seen the revenue slowly but surely decrease because everybody's realizing it's more optional and they don't necessarily need to provide that. In addition, I think we've all seen with low interest rates, what you're getting on savings account isn't what it used to be. So I think overall we've seen revenue shortfall in that program, and what we're requesting is simply a other funds adjustment of $500,000 reduction in other funds because, again, we don't need a limitation because the revenue isn't there. Package 090 is related to program reductions. These are reductions made to the general fund in the governor's recommended budget. The two programs, total reductions within the budget is $838,000 for our statewide homeless assistance program. Currently, our base operating budget for 2003-05 is 2.7. In the 2005-07 governor's recommended budget will be at $1.9 million. What this means in terms of people is about 9,816 less served in our homeless program, which the bulk of that will be coming emergency shelters. The statewide homeless assistance is primarily focused on emergency shelters. The total on that would be about 7,579 less served for 2005-07. The other reduction to the general fund is in our homeownership assistance program. That's a $250,000 reduction. Currently, base budget for that is $776,000 per biennium. Through this reduction, we will move to $544,000 for the biennium, and where we will see the bulk of the reduction is in our home buyer education program. The homeownership assistance works to serve on home buyer education as well as the down payment assistance, and in addition, I mentioned the regional housing centers provides some funding support for that. What we're projecting in terms of numbers served or less numbers served in 2005-07 is about 2,100 people. Again, primarily 2,000 less people being provided with home buyer education. So again, that's related to the program reductions for general fund. That, Mr. Chairman, unless there's any other questions related to that, I'll move into the department's supporting self-sufficiency package.
Sure. Senator Carter.
So then, if there's a housing shortage, let's say in North Northeast Portland, we have 98% occupancy, and you have a program of that nature for the Fed. How does home buying education help people in an environment like ours where you have occupancy rates so high?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, in terms of the program itself, I think we spoke a little bit, I think, to Senator Verger's question yesterday. These programs are primarily teaching them the budget skills, the necessary life skills to help them, once they move into home ownership,
okay,
to be successful. So it's primarily focused on home ownership. You're going to own your first home, and you know, what are the necessary skills that you should have in place to be successful so that
you... So it's not by area. You teach them where, if they want to go 60 miles away in Oregon to get a... Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to move into the first policy, packaged proposed by the department, the supporting self-sufficiency programs, and this is package 101. This is a $45.8 million budget package, of which $43.6 million is federal rent subsidies. And Marlis has actually kind of taken a majority of my presentation here, but this particular package does include the positions that we spoke about in terms of the Section 8 project base. And I do want to clarify something that Senator Johnson was asking about in terms of the 14 positions. The Section 8 project base assistance program is actually 11.37 FTE, and where you get in the 14 is that the benefit of this particular contract is, as Marlis spoke to, they do a great job. They get incentives, and it allows us to be able to do more things, and those more things include information technology as well as architectural. So those three positions, two of them are related to information technology, and one of them is related to architectural consultants. So just wanted to make sure that we're clear on that. The total package is for 16.37 FTE. Again, 11.37 is related to Section 8. We have one position that is our homeless assistance program, and then we have four other positions, two information technology, one architectural, and the last position is a service outreach, and I'll speak to each of those. Again, Marlis has talked a lot about the Section 8 project-based assistance. It was established on September 1st of 2000. She's already indicated that there has been a letter from HUD that is going to renew that for 10 years. We currently provide services for 171 contracts throughout Oregon, which is approximately 6,133 units of affordable housing. The one adjustment, and I do want to mention that there is, we've had 11 FTE in the past. We're asking for an additional 0.37. This is just from workload related to the management of the position. We've had a current 0.13, and it's kind of hard to get a 0.13 staff, so we've really needed the additional help, and so we're asking that to go from a 0.13 to a 0.50. So that's where I come up with the 0.37. The other piece, as I mentioned, the homeless assistance program, we are asking for additional FTE. This particular position was established as limited duration in the 2003 session. We are asking for it to be permanent. Currently, the department operates about $12.8 million of homeless assistance program. One of the big areas that we've expanded in over the last few years is called the continuum of care. You heard a little bit about that from Jack yesterday. And this program is, I will say, very complex in terms of its administration. But that, along with the additional needs that we have in our homeless assistance program, either through providing technical assistance to partners, compliance monitoring, contract performance outcomes, evaluation, training, reporting, working with our partners. We need another staff. We currently have one permanent. This one's been limited duration. We're again requesting this to be a full-time position going into 05-07. The last four positions, as I alluded to, is is the architectural position, and this one was actually established as limited duration with the other 11 back in 1999 through the emergency board. And again, this position works with another architect, a permanent architect in the department, where they're primarily focusing on the architectural designs of the projects that we get through. They at any time are working on upward to 66 projects in a given year. Through that process, I mean, they go through a comprehensive evaluation that, you know, is initial design, looking at that, making the amendments, working with the partners, making sure that there any adjustments that are needed are made, and they're within department standards. So, again, this position has been on staff for a long time, working with our other architect. It's a key position to what we do through our consolidated funding cycle. And again, we would request that this position be full-time. It is funded and supported through dollars related to the HUD contract administration.
How do you cross-train? How do you avoid bottlenecks?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
Avoid bottlenecks in the event of illness or someone leaving and moving on. I'm looking at your organizational chart here, and organizationally, and I have no desire to get into micromanaging. I'm just trying to think through if you have someone gone or leaves in key positions, it could really put a wrench into your operations.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want necessarily to argue with you on that. I think that our agency is very, very specialized, and from a total staffing standpoint, I mean, for the amount of budget that we administer, there is, you know, relatively lean in terms of total staffing. I think we have a lot of specialized positions as well. We do, from a cross-training standpoint, is, you know, with the two architects on staff, I mean, that's probably what's leading into this. I mean, certainly we have two, and they obviously will back up one another. We have, in the past, where necessary, we can get, you know, architectural contracts, people to come in and, you know, and help us in terms of some design review. That has been something. But we have been fortunate enough over the last 5 to 6 years to have two very qualified architects on staff that assist us.
Let me digress off of that, because I understand you could contract there. What happens if, and I missed the page, but what happens if one of your loan processors is gone? You have loan officers, you have three or four of them in one area with one loan processor.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if he or she's gone?
Well,
who picks up that load?
Mr. Chairman, I would say, in for example, single family, we have two loan officers that work in the single family. In the multifamily, we have three loan officer positions. Basically, they do back up one another. There's a lot of work in terms of assisting each other. I think that we do a lot of cross training as much as we can within the existing staff to help one another.
Let me give you an example.
Okay.
Okay, I know what loan officers do. I'm one. What I'm worried about is the loan closer, mm-hmm. the person putting the documents together. And I'm looking at housing finance section manager, and I see three loan specialists and a loan closer. Mm-hmm. Who's picking up the work if the loan closer is on maternity leave, sick? Leads.
Well, as Mr. Reepbein said, that's not allowed. Mr.
Delivery ward.
Mr. Chairman, I think, again, in terms of loan, to answer your question, who would fill in? It would be the loan officer themselves. I mean, you have three loan officers, and Mr. Chairman, I know that there is a lot of differences between the loan officer work, the loan closer work, but we do, again, we tend to do as much, and that's why we have to, as an agency, work very diligently with our cross-training and making sure that our staff are trained and evaluated. I think one of the things, and I don't want to digress, but I mean, us as a strategic plan, that's one of our big focuses going into 0507. How can we make sure our staff are trained and getting the necessary tools that they need so that we can, you know, move this. If this person were to leave, that someone else could come into that position and be able to pick up the work.
Well, you're the experts. It's just an observation as I look through that you have some real critical bottlenecks that could occur to you. But you're the expert.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Does that cross-training apply to those compliance officers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it most certainly does. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the next, as I mentioned, we had four positions in this package that were related to outreach and accountability. One of those was the architect that we were just speaking to. In addition, we have two other FTE, limited duration. These two have been along for the ride and journey with other 12 positions since, actually one of them since 1999. The other one was in 2001. These are information technology positions. And what we've, again, the benefits of having the HUD contract has allowed us and afforded us the ability to do some additional things with information technology. One of our key systems, initiatives in-house is the OPIS, and that is not an acronym. It is just really the name as the OPIS application, and it's related to our anti-poverty programs. It's a key application in managing those programs that the agency has been under development. We have reported to the legislature in the past on the, under the guidance of Ms. Brown to talk a little bit more about that that system and the benefits that it provide. Currently, we have about 508 users of the OPIS application, 66 agencies, which manage about 289 programs. The positions that we do have, one of those is related to specifically OPIS as it gets in more of its maturity stage and continuing the ongoing maintenance of that. It's going to require a lot of training, a lot of assistance, working with the users of it and making sure that everything is managed appropriately. So that's what one position will focus on. The other one will be mostly on system analysis to support other department programs. Currently, we have about 150 FTE within the agency. One of the ratios that I was given from, I believe it's the Gartner Group, what they recommend in the IT industry, staffing to help desk ratio is about 50-1. Between 50-1 to 75-1, so this one position would put us, you know, around 75 on the higher end of the ratio. So we are essentially requesting that one position. Satish talked a little bit about the scenic package that's going to be included. I guess it would be appropriate to share that, at least in terms of our early analysis, that will be about two FTE that will lead the agency that is specifically for network help. That's what we have provided the Department of Administrative Services as a package. So, again, Satish has put a placeholder in that for that final analysis, but we'll lose those positions to the senior process, which, again, will be administered through the statewide database. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to move into my second package, which is affordable housing and strong communities.
Really quick before you do that, I'm looking on page 48 through 54. Do we have any housing loan programs that are targeted or focused directly on Oregon National Guardsmen? If the answer is no, the answer is no. I'm just...
Mr. Chairman, the answer is not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, being whispered in my ears, we have service programs that they would be eligible for.
I'm not mean to digress, committee.
I'll just make it quick, Mr. Chairman. That's Bob Riepine, Director of Oregon Housing Community Services. There was a letter or a directive that came out from the governor's office asking all agencies to go through their programs to see what kind of services either are available or can be modified to address the current wave of military people who are engaged in service right now overseas or in the state. We've shared with the governor's office and the Department of Administrative Services a list of our other programmatical program services like food programs, rental assistance programs, things like that, where we've given them direct links to the guards people, to our community partners, so they can access those. As far as the first-time homebuyer program, really the veterans program. In the state of Oregon, we have a state veterans loan program. Unfortunately, because of the threshold date of the eligibility for veterans has not been modified by the federal government, today's warriors who are serving this state and this nation are not eligible for veterans loans because it won't move the eligibility date. You'd have to be just at the end of post-World Vietnam to be eligible, so anybody who has served in the military past that is not eligible for a veterans loan. So many of those people are being somewhat cheated out of that aspect, but they are generally eligible for, in a general population, eligible for our first-time homebuyer program.
Terrific. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just to jump back really, really quick, Policy Package 101, I just want to make sure that when everybody hears $45.8 million, that it's doesn't doesn't jump out to you. The 43.6 of that 45.8 is the actual subsidies through the HUD contract administration. These are the subsidy just passes through to the landlords that help them reduce the rent to make sure that people don't pay no more than 30% of their income on housing. So I just wanted to make that statement on the record to assure you that the majority of that is related to our subsidy. The next package is Package 102, Affordable Housing Strong Communities. $685,000 is being requested. Of that, $458,000 is related to other funds, $226,000 federal fund. There is no general fund request on that. This is for 5.5 FTE total package. Of that 5.5 FTE, three of those are limited duration, again, that were established last session. These are related to, as you heard Marla speak a little bit on the housing program management side, this is to be differentiated between the HUD contract administration, which is primarily for the HUD financed Section 8 project. These are for our own, I should say, it's actually for our entire portfolio of properties. And as Marla had mentioned earlier, the ratio in terms of projects to people. And right now we're looking at 64 projects per year per compliance officer. If you look at some of the standards, I don't know if Marlis had mentioned this, some of the standards that are provided through a national affiliate, they like to see anywhere between 40 and 50 projects per FTE. So you can see that we're well above that standard. If you look at our portfolio, the way it's been increasing over the last year, it was increased by 11%, and we're expecting a 20% jump in 0507. Going into next year, we're expecting 77 projects per compliance specialist. Again, Marlis spoke to a lot of the efficiencies that we've tried to put in place through our little digital review tools, and I think that we do the best we can in terms of managing the work. Certainly as the portfolio will continue to grow, there will be a need to look at potentially new positions in the future.
Senator Johnson.
It's been a long time since we've seen this presentation document, and I just don't remember. How many FTE are you asking for in the aggregate?
In the total policy package and essential package, we're asking for 25.37 FTE, of which 1.87 are brand new.
1.87 FTE.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, the next position, again, established in 2003, is limited duration. This is related to our home program, approximately $20 million program. We've seen over the years that the home program itself has become much more complex. The way we administer a lot of our dollars through our housing resource section is we have individual staff people that work on a variety of projects, because a lot of these projects have maybe a little bit of home money, a little bit of trust fund dollars, a little bit of tax credit, and they manage a portfolio of projects. The home program is a little unique in that it does a variety of things. It does provide money for our consolidated funding cycle. We also have a tenant-based assistance program, as well as providing some funding for the regional housing centers. So what we needed was a position that specifically worked on that grant and worked through the complications through the rules and regulations that the feds provide, and that this position would manage that particular program. So we are asking for that position to be, again, it's LD. We're asking it to establish that as permanent. We don't see the HUD rules getting any easier in terms of administration, and we have a huge need in terms of that particular program.
Let me ask you a quick question, mm-hmm. and I'm digressing, and I apologize for that. I'm looking at the agency activity summaries, 47 again through 54, and I'm seeing multiple little programs. Is that because those are tools you need to assist other tools? Let me give you an example. I'm looking at the Energy Rated Homes of Oregon program with $1,000 in it.
Mr. Chairman, you would have to pick on that one. How about another one? Mr. Chairman, I do want to say that program, as you may recall, was of our 53 programs, ranked number 53. and that was a small program that we did try to get off the ground several years ago, in which we helped people out through getting a ratings of their homes to see where they might be able to provide more efficiencies. I will say that the program never took off as much as we would have hoped it would have. And so I would say that that one program that you had mentioned is probably not a tool that necessarily enhances all of our other ones. Now, on those other small programs, if you were to ask me about those, such as, let's say, the pre-development loan program, or the pre-development loan program is, I think with affordable housing, and you've heard some of the public testimony, I think it's not a matter of, I think affordable housing takes time. It's not something you just go out and say, okay, I'm gonna create multifamily affordable housing complex and be done with it and get a loan and we're done. I think that over time that you might need to secure money. There might be seed money dollars that are needed to pay for architectural design, things like that, that actually get the project up to the point of becoming a affordable housing project.
Let me think this really quickly, just in the interest of moving this along. Senator Johnson, in another committee, in our morning committee and in other budgets we've looked at, is asked the agencies during the interim if they could just go through, read all their statutes, look through their stuff, and perhaps next session come back if there's any areas where you can just say, why is this on the book still? And if you could, in 24 months perhaps, be prepared to come back and say, we looked through all of our statutes, we don't know why we're doing this, and we're going to use a little tough love here and clean it up and move on. So if you could just keep that in the back of your mind, and in 24 months, I'm sure Senator Johnson will remember this.
And Mr. Chairman, we will be happy to do that. And just, I guess, one last plug. I mean, a lot of these small programs do enhance our larger programs and build forward. So it's tools that could get us there.
If it were an empty vessel into which the Energy Trust of Oregon could pour money for the benefit of your program, I would relish the opportunity to keep it.
I'm sorry.
We'll keep going.
With that, would you like me to move on, Mr. Chairman?
in fairness to Satish, how much time are you going to need to think?
Well, I'm done, Mr. Chair.
You're up here for moral support.
Mr. Chairman, last portion of Package 102, the Affordable Housing Strong Communities. This is the 1.5 new FTE, besides the 0.37 I mentioned earlier, but the 1.5 brand new FTE. One of those positions is related to weatherization. Through Senate Bill 1149, the public purpose charge, we got additional money for our weatherization dollars. We have been able to move a lot of that money into our housing programs and do weatherization grants. The position that was initially established that works in the weatherization program works primarily with our community action programs. We need a position that will work more with our affordable housing partners in terms of doing the appropriate energy efficiencies, doing the technical assistance that's necessary. Again, just managing the grant piece that we're giving through our housing process. The 0.5 is Office Specialist 2. Currently, Mr. Chairman, you talked about the housing finance section a little bit ago. That particular section does not have any office support. And you asked me, well, who does it if the going closes in? And I said the loan officer. Well, the loan officer also does the support work, too, because they have no support staff. And, I think that with multifamily housing, I think you will have peaks and valleys. There will be those really busy times. There will be those really slow times. But I think one of the things that we forget is there's a lot of portfolio management goes. There's a lot of transfers of properties. They have to re-underwrite these things. Mr. Chairman, you know better than anyone in terms of that. And I think this position will provide the necessary support work on a long, ongoing basis.
I just want to make sure you folks don't find yourselves in a bottleneck, and make sure this body's responsive at this time if you see those.
Mr. Chairman, I'm on my last two policy packages, and they're relatively small. There is no more positions to talk about, but the one that I just get really excited about, and I'm sure Bob Repine does too, is Ensuring Accountability and Supporting Self-Sufficiency Program. This is an $860,000 other funded package. Just to cut to the chase, what this package is about is providing dollars for what is known as a liquidity provider. And the department got into the game in 2003-2005 of issuing variable rate debt.
The business, not the game.
Excuse me, the game. That's the variable rate. What we need a variable rate debt for was basically, in the past, we'd issue fixed-rate bonds. With the interest rates where they were going, everything was going down. There was a lot of compression in the market. So from being able to provide the lowest interest rate possible, you couldn't do it with just a fixed-rate bond structure. Variable-rate debt is very, very low right now. And by blending that into our fixed rate, we were able to achieve much lower rates. We've been able to hold about a 4.95% interest rate for the majority of the binding, which is, if you look compared to the private sector, it's very low, provides affordable housing to the people that we're trying to, you know, the 70-80%.
So are there ceilings on those, and then other people? And then second question is, are prepayment penalties? Are you able to take those out at some point if you need to?
Typically, when we do an issue, are you talking about the variable rate nature?
Yeah,
or
variable rate.
There are caps on those. We usually build those in. I mean, I will say, I mean, they're 9% variable rates. Now, I mean, probably a question that's popping up in your mind is that, okay, what if? You know, what if those do go up? And I will address that, but just real quickly, just so everybody understands what we're asking for here. When you issue variable rate debt, and if you're the bondholder, you have the option as a bondholder of variable rate debt to tender that at any point. Unlike fixed rate, you go on trading in the open market. You have the right, rates go down, you have the right to tender that. It's the job of the remarketing agent to take that, because the money's been tied up into a mortgage, to take that and remarket it to another bondholder. If that remarketing agent isn't able to do it, then you need someone to come in and say, I'm going to buy those bonds. That's the liquidity provider. Now, they go out and they pledge that if they need to come and pick up those bonds, they'll be there. Now, they're going to obviously get compensated for that, as well as the remarketing agent, which brings me to why we're asking for $860,000. Now, looking at Monica, we've talked a little bit about in the need to adjust this package. I think probably overshot this a little bit. I thought we might issue a little bit more variable rate. We're more at a $615,000 package now, so because we didn't issue, because it's based on how much variable rate bonds you have outstanding in any given point. That's how the fee for the liquidity provider is. So the more risk they're taking, the more they're compensated.
I don't do bond financing, but the question I have is, if rates were to increase and it made sense for us to, you know, looking out, projecting out, saying, hey, rates are going to continue to rise, do we have the ability to take out these existing bonds and refinance them with fixed rate
bonds,
where we can lock them in?
Mr. Chairman, excellent question, and that's exactly where I wanted to go next. You asked about the cap. There is a cap, but you know, obviously it goes 9-10%. That's bad. First of all, I want to state that when we do variable rate issuance, the rating agencies require us to do very strenuous cash flows. They want to know if those bonds go up to 9%, you're still going to be able to pay the bondholders. So we are required as an issuer to go some pretty extreme cash flows and ensure that our dollars are going to be there to pay the debt service. So that's the first. The second is, one of the reasons that we started issuing variable rate debt is that the legislature was kind enough to pass legislation to allow the department to do interest rate swaps. And basically, that is an agreement where we can go in and exchange the variable rate debt for a synthetic fix. So that is the tool that we utilize to hedge. So, Mr. Chairman, $860,000 package, more like $615,000, and that's package 103. The last package, Mr. Chairman, is package 104. I see that as a bit of a technical adjustment. Basically, we're asking to shift approximately $568,000 of other funds to federal funds, and there is a reason behind that. We as a department have over the years been able to basically pay our way. We, through our bond programs, have been able to generate the necessary dollars to pay for the administrative overhead. We've taken very small portions of general fund dollars, and we've also tried to save as much money in our federal funds as possible, so that most of it goes out to the community. Typically, if you have 5%, then maybe we would take 2%. The problem is, Mr. Chairman, is that the dollars that we have enjoyed through our housing finance fund, the distributions that are approved, they're not there. The reason they're not there is, a couple reasons. One, the economy in housing has been, at least for us, with the interest rates being low, there's been huge amounts of prepayments. In 2004, we had approximately $153 million worth of prepayments. That's compared to about $37 million back in 2000. that's our assets that are basically going away. Now, obviously, we have the ability to refund, put new mortgages out if it's eligible, and as I think Bob spoke to yesterday, now's a great time to be building that portfolio with 4.9% interest rates. You're probably not going to see those kind of rates again in a long time. So if you can generate those kind of assets, they're going to be there for the long term. So now's the time to do it. The problem is the damage is done, and our distributions have gone down a great deal over the last several years.
I want to stop you really mm-hmm. quick there, and I don't want to correct that statement, but I want to bring another perspective on it. You know, the role of the state of Oregon is to assist folks to do something that they otherwise won't be able to do. And so the notion that they're taking out the state means you have now completed your function. Right. And you've helped someone get into their home, you've helped them to do whatever the project is, they now no longer need the assistance of the state, they've paid their money back, and that those dollars are now available to help someone out.
Right.
From a business perspective, which, as the finance guy, you have to carry that. Yes, it does. It tightens your cash flow extraordinarily.
Right. So my question was going to be that if there's prepayment, are there any sanctions for early payments whatsoever?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, no, there's not on the residential loans, on the single-family homeownership loans. There is no prepayment on multifamily, which our policy is not to allow any prepayment on that, but there is penalties on those.
So in order for you to, in terms of future loans, though, in order for you to reap the kind of interest benefits that you're looking for, can't you build in some kind of period of time by which they cannot pay the loan back in order for you to benefit as an agency and recoup those dollars?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I think probably the biggest issue there is to be in a competitive nature in the mm-hmm. banking business.
Yeah, that's right.
No, not many people would sign up for that program, I don't think, if they could just go down the street and didn't have to be faced with a prepayment penalty.
So that's the attractiveness of it.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, just to provide just a little context in terms of
I just want to put on the record for this. The issue you're raising is a sign of success.
Right.
These are loans that have paid back.
Right. Right.
So it's a good problem to have.
Mr. Chairman, I don't mean to discount that fact, and that you're right. And obviously, as you know, though, I'm looking at it from a financial standpoint and trying to make sure that the department continues to pay and be able to provide the dollars necessary, not only for housing, but for our anti-poverty program.
I'm trying to
give
you a penalty, but you just didn't take it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I appreciate that. Just real quickly, Mr. Chairman, in terms of what we've seen with our distribution in our account, in 2002, we were enjoying a distribution from our housing finance account of approximately $8.2 million. In 2004, that's $6.8 million. So you can see that our ability to take out of our bond indentures to pay for our operational cost has diminished a great deal. To add to that, if you look in 2001, our change in net assets, or if you'd like to see it as profit, $17.3 million according to our 2001 financials. In 2004, $15.5 million loss. What that's done for us as a housing financial, obviously we are concerned and we are doing what we can. What you're seeing a lot is that you're getting all these prepayments that are coming in. They're sitting in accounts before they call. You're getting 2% on the earnings in a trust in an account, but you're paying 4 or 5% on debt. Right. There's that time period in which you've got to refund those bonds.
There's not a profit out there that's not experiencing this right now.
So
everyone's in the same.
I think, you know, again, so the economy's been difficult. In addition, we've had $3.8 million taken out of the Housing Finance Fund over the last two sessions. There's been transfers, legislative transfers to back to our homeless programs. That has had an impact. It's an annuity. You take from that annuity, your distributions in the future is going to be smaller. And so we are asking to – so what we've been able to do aggressively is to be able to use more of our federal fund dollars. That means probably less dollars will be going out programmatically. But it is – we have the right to use those federal dollars as admin and be able to maintain our staff, which, you know, I guess in closing – I know I'm running late and I apologize. But in closing, I think that you look at the staff, it is a – you know, for the amount of work that this organization does, it's a relatively small staff, and I think there's enormous amounts of work that are put in. Again, we're asking for 25.37 FTE, only 1.87 is new. I think that I think that in terms of the request, that's what we need to continue to be able to efficiently operate. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, before you close the put the gavel down, again, for the record, Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing Community Services. Two things worth noting. If Senator Johnson would like to see us consider that request about using the energy trust dollars in that $1,000 line allocation, I'm sure, as I had a council over here with my staff, that there's probably ways we can create something that would be very meaningful in the resources of those dollars. And finally, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to talk, there was a lot of discussion about limited duration and what it means. You and I know, and the rest of the members know, that the process is you ask for positions. If it's limited, then you come back, and usually it says, well, we don't feel comfortable full-time, so come back in 2 years and tell us what you've done. We've been faced with a couple of issues in the last three sessions. One is we've tried not to increase the state population and employment to show in good faith to the citizens of Oregon that government can control its growth and its spending. That has a kind of a artificial tempering of what we really do, so we assign limited duration positions to kind of work under that cloak. I think the issue is really more the if you were a part of a, and I would like to, many of you have not been to the agency. We're 150 strong, and we're a very small agency. We all house in the same place other than for six of us. And we are, for all practical purposes, a very close, integrated, friendly family. And we know when somebody has a marriage in their family, and we know when somebody has a death in their family, and we know when somebody has somebody graduating and when somebody's got a christening. We celebrate those things, and we cry for those things. So when you have people who are both dedicated, who, if in the case of, you said, well, what happens if so-and-so takes leave? And as I looked over to my right-hand side and saw these three ladies sitting here, they represent a large piece of the financial work that Rick does. But I'll tell you that if there was some personal illness or something that affected either one, any of those people or anybody in their section, they would work 10 hours a day. They would shift their workloads around amongst each other to make sure that the work was covered, because they know the importance to the end product or the end user, and that's the citizen out there. So I think we are cut above most state agencies. We are a group that work together and do what we have to do to be successful, and whatever that means, we will accomplish that. And I think that's a key piece of the second part that I want to make, and that's the limited duration piece. It really is difficult. When you heard in 1999 we approved these positions, and we told our staff people when we hired them they were going to be limited duration, but if they did their work well and we were able to prove or perfect the longer term relationship with HUD, that the Legislative Assembly has said to us, come back and explain and we'll consider it. Well, we did that in 1999. We did that as the E-Board. We came in 2001. We came in 2003. And now we're in 2005. Sure, I can go back and tell the people, you know, we just didn't get it again. But sooner or later, they stop believing in you. And that's the critical piece when you run a family-type business. And this is a family business.
Well, I can definitely tell you run a TQM-type management style.
Yeah.
Because when I was looking at the flow chart, you could see that your deputy and your chief financial officer don't answer to the director.
Chairman, committee members, I would tell you unequivocally, if there was anybody in the process of the Oregon Housing Community Services that wouldn't have to be there, it would be me. Because this agency can run themselves without me.
Well, let me share it with you, Director Repine. I think you folks have done a fabulous job. I think you have a fabulous staff. I think you do a fabulous job reaching out to all Oregonians, and you're to be commended for that. I definitely hope this committee will take what you've brought forward with careful consideration, because I think you have made a strong argument. I can attest that if I was in that situation and I was looking at every 2 years, knowing whether or not I would have a job, you'd question your loyalty, and then that would make it difficult for everyone. So we appreciate that. Seeing no other comments, we're going to adjourn for the day and until round three. Great job.